From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For a recent book, a Washington Post reporter tells expansive but personal stories of what happened to Janesville after its GM plant closed.
I really wanted to explain to people what really happens when work goes away, what happens to families, what happens to community. I mean, I really wanted to learn these things, and I was grateful that people were generous in sharing with me what had happened to them.
Later, contributor and cellist Robert Cohen talks about the odd phenomenon of playing a performance with a former student.
If I think too hard about it, I realize, yes, I'm the old teacher. But at the same time, I feel, you know, I'm so connected with her and the way she plays now that that gives me a kind of boost of energy as well.
And writer Paul Theroux shares his story of the tyrannical mother at the center of his new novel, Motherland.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In December 2008, General Motors shuttered its nearly century-old assembly plant in Janesville, Wisconsin. The resulting ripple effect led as many as 9,000 people in the city and surrounding communities to lose their jobs.
A new book by Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein called Janesville, An American Story, puts that factory closure into a broader context. The book examines what first led to Janesville's heyday, the aftermath of the GM plant's closure, and explores why it's so difficult in cities like Janesville to rebuild a stable working class. Speaking by phone from Washington, Goldstein explains how Janesville first got on her radar screen.
I heard about Janesville probably early 2009 when I was actually looking for a setting for a story that I was doing for the Washington Post. And somebody mentioned to me that there was this Wisconsin town I'd never heard of before that had just lost a very old, very large General Motors plant. And at the time, I didn't go to Janesville because the closing was new. And a lot of the people who had worked at General Motors were still getting union subpay, good unemployment benefits through the GM contract, as well as their unemployment benefits. So the economic pain hadn't really begun to sink in for a lot of people. So I didn't do that story in Janesville. But when I began thinking about doing a larger piece of work, looking at what happens to an ordinary community when a lot of its best jobs go away, Janesville lingered in my mind.
So you started writing the story in 2011, but the book really starts in 2008, before the GM plant shuts down.
That's right. So I began doing the research for this book and making trips out to Janesville in 2011. I first stepped into town the summer of 2011 and started getting to know the community, understanding what had happened there, understanding what these job losses meant to people. And as I was doing this, basically reporting, as I would do for my regular job at the Washington Post, I began to talk to people about what had happened before I showed up, because, as you say, the plant closed 2 days before Christmas of 2008, so I needed to understand what had preceded my arrival in town.
It was really interesting reading this book because I'm actually from a small town sort of near Janesville. And at times in high school, you know, we had these rivalries with one of the high schools called Janesville Craig. Of course, I wasn't aware of who Joseph A. Craig was or how he had transformed the city. And as the story progresses, we really see how transformative that one act bringing the GM plant to Janesville. It really was. Were you surprised by the sheer impact the plant had on the city?
Well, I was struck that for a fairly small city, Janesville has not one but two iconic industrialists who really shaped both the economy and the identity of Janesville. And the first person was the man who founded Parker Penn, which also was based in Janesville. He founded this little pen company that grew and grew in the 1880s. So by the turn of the century, Parker Penn was already reaching into international markets. So the small city of Janesville had, even by then, a sense of itself as reaching to the wider world. And then, as you say, Joseph A. Craig came along. He had been the guy who was running a farm implements manufacturer. And the man who at the time was the head of General Motors, a man named Durant, knew that he was a good businessman and wanted to hire him. So he invited Joseph A. Craig to Detroit one day to have a meeting about whether he was going to hire him. By the end of that meeting, Craig had persuaded the head of General Motors to move into Janesville. And the first thing that was made at the Janesville Assembly Plant starting in 1919, a long time ago, was tractors. And then in 1923, the first Chevrolets were being made. So this was an assembly plant that had a long, deep history in town.
Something that's interesting, I think, for Wisconsinites especially, is when outsiders come and look in. As I'm sure you kind of learned when you were in Janesville, we tend to be a little insular. How did you forge the relationships with the people in the book? Because they share such intimate details of their lives. It seems like something you might not tell someone you don't know that well.
Well, I forged each relationship one at a time, and I didn't ask people the most intimate things up front. So I first paid a visit to town and had tried to learn before I arrived who were a few people who might be really important for me to start to get to know. So I met with a longtime journalist in town. I met with the man who was the head of the job center, the Southwest Wisconsin Workforce Development Board. And I met with people who were running the United Auto Workers Local 95. There were two retirees who were the president and vice president of the local at that point, since the workers were no longer in their jobs to be running the local. There were retirees doing it. And I just began to talk to people about what had happened and why and what their experiences were like and what they saw having in town. And each person I met, I asked, who else should I get to know? And I was really grateful that people, you know, were willing to share their experiences with me. You know, one of the things I said to people was that I really wanted to explain to people who hadn't been through this kind of an economic trauma what really happens when work goes away, what happens to families, what happens to a community. I mean, I really wanted to learn these things, and I was grateful that people were generous in sharing with me what had happened to them.
And that's another kind of idea, this idea of an economic trauma. I know when I've tried to explain to people, I went to school in the East Coast, when I've tried to explain to people there what it's like to live in a town like Janesville or Kenosha, another town that I lived near, they don't quite get it. When you started explaining the kind of concept for this book to people who, I'm guessing you were working likely with people on the East Coast, did they get it?
I think they did. I mean, one of the ideas I had when I began all of this work was that I wanted to write about one community as a metaphor for what was going on in lots of places in the United States out of this big thing that was called the Great Recession of 2007 to mid-2009. And my idea was that there were lots of people in lots of kinds of fields who had lost work or knew people who had lost work or were apprehensive that they might lose work. So I thought that if I could show in one community what was happening, that perhaps other people could identify with this and learn from it.
Do you think at the time things started happening in 2008, and you get to this in the book, of course, do you think people really recognized what was happening or what could happen?
One of the things that struck me was when I first began visiting Janesville, which was 2.5 years after the assembly plant had closed, I kept hearing people in town telling me, just wait, it's still going to reopen. I mean, that was a pretty widespread hope for years. And I think that that hope persisted because the assembly plant had been the heart of Janesville's economy for so long. And over the decades, it had lost products, it had gained products. And even when times got hard and there were layoffs for a period, another product had always come in to replace it. So the expectation when the plant stopped producing the SUVs it was making was that, of course, something else would come in. So I think that there was a lot of denial that this could be permanent this time. And there was just an expectation based on all the decades of this plant's centrality in Janesville's economy that it was going to get going again. So it took a long time for people to understand that this time was going to be different.
when we talk about the centrality of this plant, the GM plant, I mean, when we talk about these kinds of factories closing, I think so often we leave it at, oh, the GM plant is closed and this meant, you know, 1,300 jobs are gone. But it didn't just mean that for Janesville, right?
That's exactly right. So not everybody in or near Janesville worked in the auto industry. But Janesville was really at the heart of a lot of jobs. As you just said, there were a number of supplier companies in town or in Rock County or nearby counties that were producing parts or other services for the assembly plant. And when the plant closed down, it was like a cascade. Those jobs went away. Lear Seating, which made the seats for the assembly plant, had about 800 people at the end, so a lot of people lost their jobs then. And then there was a second wave. So there was assembly plant closing, there was supplier companies closing. And then, as the economy was still so bad and so many people were losing work, small businesses in town were losing employees or closing themselves in some cases. Restaurants didn't have enough business. Small businesses just couldn't keep going because the economy was lousy in town.
So one of the moments that struck me in the book was one of the families who you profile was helping put together these bags of hope, free groceries for people in need, only to take one home for themselves. And it was odd to think that someone donating their time would actually need that donation themselves. It seemed to speak to kind of this larger idea that people really do kind of cover up as much as they can that they're in pain. Do you think even now that there are people in Janesville, that there are people in the surrounding areas that really don't recognize what has happened since 2008?
Well, one of the things that I think I learned spending time in Janesville and getting to know people there was that families that had been middle-class families really try to go to great lengths to keep up things on the surfaces. I mean, if you drive through Janesville, I remember being very surprised the first time I arrived in town and I was just driving around the streets. And I knew the numbers of jobs that had gone away, but I thought, this doesn't look like an economically depressed place. It looks pretty nice. And I think that people really try to, as much as possible, keep their lives going and keep the appearances of their lives going. So, for instance, there are two teenage twins in the story, and I remember them telling me that they would buy jeans at Goodwill, but they would really look and look and look through the jeans there until they could find designer jeans that had been donated and were now used jeans so that nobody would know that they weren't buying new jeans. I mean, they wanted nice clothes. I mean, who wouldn't? So I think that there's been a real attempt both to sort of keep life going and to keep appearances going.
Have you received any feedback from the people you interviewed for the book? Have any of them read it?
I have heard from people. It's actually been touching. I've heard from people who have thanked me for writing this book. I was in Janesville about a week ago and saw a few of the people in the book, and they were congratulating me for having finished it. It took a long time. So it was really nice to see people who let me into their lives in this way so that I could tell their story.
I think especially since the election that we just had, the presidential election, a lot of people are going to look at this book and go, well, this is the voice of Trump voters in a lot of ways. You know, these are blue-collar, working-class families, many of whom switched from being Obama supporters, as many of these people were at the beginning of the book, to voting for Donald Trump. Do you think that's an accurate characterization? Do you think that's something that – do you think it's appropriate or inappropriate to look at the book through that lens?
Well, the political relevance of the book, I think, is interesting because Janesville is an old UAW town. It's pretty heavily Democratic, and its county, Rock County, Wisconsin, is pretty Democratic. So I looked at the election results. In 2012, 62% of Rock County's voters supported Barack Obama for re-election. This time, 52% voted for Hillary Clinton. So this was not a balanced Trump-supporting part of Wisconsin, even though the state as a whole went for Donald Trump. But I think that what maybe can fairly be said is that the kinds of economic experiences that people in Janesville have gone through. In other parts of the United States, with working class people in communities that perhaps aren't quite so heavily Democratic, those experiences may have motivated people to support a candidate who is talking about change.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get out of this book?
Well, I hope that people learn a few things. I hope that people understand that ordinary places can go through hard times. And, you know, places that go through hard times, and in the case of Janesville, people have tried and are still trying really hard to find new paths forward. It's not an easy thing to do, and I find that Janesville's a pretty resilient place, and I wanted readers of this book to understand what trying hard looks like. I also was hoping that this book maybe can stoke a little bit of empathy, that people who are living perfectly middle-class lives, who are doing everything right, can have an economic event come along that really changes the path of their life. And I wanted people to see what that looks like up close.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Goldstein is a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Janesville, An American Story. We spoke with her in May ahead of an event at Boswell Book Company.
A short break now, and then cellist Robert Cohen talks about what it's like to play a concert with a former student. His On That Note segment is next on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Our On That Note contributor, professional cellist Robert Cohen, often joins us from remote locations around the world. But this month, he joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the Lake Effect studio.
That's because he was back in town for a concert with the Fine Arts Quartet, one he says that was particularly noteworthy.
Not that they're not all special, of course, but one of our guests was the cellist Joseph Luptak, who, let me see, about 25 years ago was a student of mine in London. He's a Slovak cellist. And, you know, we've become such close friends, and we've been working together as well. He runs an amazing festival in Slovakia and plays all over the world, really. And we've been duo partners, and I've been guest of his, and he's been a guest of mine. And our families have sort of grown very close together. So it is always very special to have such a close friend and colleague play with you, and for me to be able to invite him here is a great feeling too. And it kind of reminds me of how many students I've taught over the years. I mean, the very first people I think was when I was touring America when I was about 18 years old, my first tours in America. And one of the things I had to do was to give masterclasses at various musical institutions on my travels. And I don't know if we talked about this before, but I think I looked about 12 years old. And the students I was teaching were all sort of in their 20s. So they didn't even realize that it was me that was supposed to be. I'd be in the room and they'd be waiting for the master to arrive to give them the class, but it was just me. So I had to teach them. I learned to be very, very clear and very, and to really demonstrate that I knew what I was talking about, even though I was younger than they were. And now I don't remember any of those students from those days, but a few years later when I started to teach a little bit more regularly, I suppose. So Joseph Luptak became one of my first students in London. And since then, there have been students from all over the world that I've taught, and some of them are particularly people who I've kept in touch with, who I can play with as well. And for instance, Nadege Rocha is a wonderful cellist who I taught relatively recently. She's the kind of the other end of the scale, so to speak, who is now a wonderful soloist and who's played with me, and I've played with her and we're in touch. And I find it fascinating to play with people who were once students of mine.
I was going to ask you if there's ever a moment when you're in a position where you're performing together where you have to stop yourself from thinking as a teacher and where you have to remember that, no, we're colleagues now, we're performing together?
Well, I don't think I need to stop myself, but I am kind of amused by the fact that they do, you know, and delighted at the fact that they do things in their own way. I can sort of see some of my roots in there, and I can see what I've helped them with a long time ago. But they've all developed, and, you know, the beautiful thing is to see that they have the freedom to speak in their own way and to interpret it in their own way. And even when we're kind of rehearsing and I'm saying, well, what about this? And they say, oh, no, let's try it this way. And I'm thinking, oh, here we go. Yes, of course, they've got their own things to say and it's definitely not going to be what I want, you know. And that is really wonderful. It is fantastic to see that. And I enjoy their individuality. And yet, obviously, you know, being friends and having a history together, there's enormous respect as well. And it's enjoyable for me also because it makes me feel younger.
Yeah, I was going to say 25 years ago is not possible. Not possible that you were teaching then.
Right? Oh, yes.
Yes,
oh, yes,
I know.
No, but there's a feeling that, you know, they're young people. Najej is only, I don't know, you know, in her 20s. So there's a feeling when I play with her, I get all that energy from this youthful, exuberant person. And if I think too hard about it, I realize, yes, I'm the old teacher. But at the same time, I feel, you know, I'm so connected with her and the way she plays now, that gives me a kind of boost of energy as well.
Do you find that you learn things from your students when you're performing together, not as teacher and pupil, but as colleagues?
Oh, constantly, yes. I do, because, and I, you know, I take some responsibility for this. Like I said before, I think one of the ways that I help people when I'm teaching them is to try to give them that enormous freedom, you know, the facility to do what they want. So when I'm playing with them and they're playing it that way and they're showing me things, I find that so stimulating. And I can show them, look, I'm decades older than you, so I've got a few tricks up my sleeve that you might like to know about now that perhaps I didn't tell you about before. And they also talk about that sometimes, like, oh, you never said things about that when you were teaching me. And I say, well, we're all growing, you know. That was maybe a long time ago, and maybe my ideas have changed or developed since that time.
Or maybe they weren't ready.
Yes.
At that point. I mean, when you talk about things like that, are you talking about techniques or approaches in the music? What kinds of things are they referring to that you didn't tell them about before?
I think sometimes technical things, perhaps specifically to do with, you know, certain approaches to how you move with the instrument. I mean, the fundamentals they understand, and I still work with the same fundamentals. But maybe, you know, there are some thoughts I've had about things over the years that have changed in some respect. And they recognize that. I think perhaps they're scrutinizing me more than I realize.
Well, it's kind of nice that they noticed.
Yeah.
When you think about it, that they're paying attention enough to say, wait a minute, that's different from what you told me 20 years ago.
Yeah. And I like that, I have to say. I really like the fact that they notice things. And it reminds me, of course, that time has gone by, but not in vain.
You're still teaching, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so do you have some students now that you look at and think, oh, I would love to be playing concerts with them in 10 years or 20 years?
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. But I never really thought about it in that way. It just happened in that way. You know, the relationship when you're teaching is such a close one. I mean, you know, you're dealing with, and we've talked about this before, you're dealing with so many psychological questions and approaches, how to be a performer, how to get on the stage. And that means all the baggage that you bring as a person. And then how to play the cello and how to use music and how to fulfill yourself. It's such a, you know, it's really in the psychiatrist's chair half the time when you're teaching. You're dealing with the person, not just the fact that they're playing the cello. So you create a kind of enormous, a relation, a serious relationship with somebody, which is perhaps, maybe one could say, kind of paternal in one sense, but also very much as a colleague, because, you know, you want to learn from what they're doing. You say something to them and they respond to that. And of course, they respond to it in a unique way. It's not like anybody else responds. So you're having to learn and work with them on the spot. And so this builds this relationship that over years, because sometimes you're teaching them for, you know, perhaps 6 years or 7 years, that closeness, if the personalities really click in a certain way, it inevitably is going to continue, inevitably. I mean, I never assume that because, of course, one also has to be professional, you know, and then people want to leave you. Maybe they want to go and start with somebody else, which they should do, you know, if they feel that that's necessary, or if they just want to have different experiences. I never expect people to continue keeping regular touch with me, but some do, and some leave it for a while and then come back to me later. And that's always a joy. I mean, it's a bit like having sort of children all over the world, really, that have taken your message, have developed it in their own way, and they're also teaching themselves now. And one of the most beautiful things I get every now and again, a message or have a quick conversation with somebody who says, I tried those things on my students and they're working so beautifully and they really enjoy them. And I'm so pleased that you explained things so carefully and you had those principles and things like that. And they're very, of course, very flattering to me, but it delights me. And the reason I'm telling you now is because it delights me that what they learned, they feel they can pass on so easily and so effectively. And so that's one of the nice things that happens when you've somehow been so involved with teaching in a personal way, and it spreads.
Well, you mentioned before we turned on the microphones, a legacy. And it's, you have a recording legacy and a performing legacy, but you also have this other legacy too.
Yeah, and I'm beginning to feel that maybe that's as important as anything through people that it literally lives. I mean, recordings are fine, and they are a snapshot of what you did at a certain moment. But this kind of living legacy, it feels more important now as I get on and have more and more experiences of teaching.
Well, Robert, it is always such a pleasure, and I always learn from our conversations. And it's just so nice to see you as opposed to talking to you over the computer. But I hope you have a wonderful summer, and we will talk next month.
You too. Absolutely.
Robert Cohen is the cellist for the Fine Arts Quartet, and he joins us each month to talk about the life of a professional musician in a segment called On That Note.
Contributor Lauren Groh's adventure along the Appalachian Trail continues. She'll check in with us from somewhere in the mountains when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Contributor Lauren Groh has been through hiking the Appalachian Trail this spring and summer. So far, she and her companions have hit several major milestones, including reaching 400 miles on the journey.
Groh checked in from the trail just recently and reflected on the day-to-day challenges of surviving such a major undertaking.
It's day 42 on the Appalachian Trail. We left Irwin, Tennessee 3 days ago, and our next stop is Hampton. We will hit the 400-mile mark tomorrow if we push it. Today we climbed to the summit of Rowan Mountain from our picturesque camping spot at Ash Gap and encountered some wild winds on the balds that followed. They were so violent that we had to walk much of them sideways and doubled over just to stay on our feet. At one point, I was hanging onto the branch of a bush for dear life. We cut our hiking day short to get out of the wind and the heavy rain that was on its way. Tonight, we will sleep in a famous bright red barn that was converted into a shelter for Appalachian Trail hikers. We got to the barn at 1:30 p.m., which ended a very short hiking day for us. Now it's 3:15, and there are at least 25 people here already, spread out across the floor of the barn. We are on the second level, and the draft from below is so bad that sleeping pads levitate when big gusts of wind come through. Risha and I strategically positioned our packs in front of the breezy gaps in between the slats in the old barn's walls. We are hoping to at least stay dry once the rain comes. Earlier, when we approached the barn, I looked to my left and saw a beautiful spread of mountains beyond a grassy meadow dotted with trees. I was amazed. Sometimes the views look the same, but whenever hiking the trail gets monotonous, a new plant emerges, or a bird sings a beautiful song, or we come across a magical waterfall. My perspective is constantly changing. I begin to notice the little buds on the trees and the raindrop-like sounds of tiny crickets hopping in the grass along the trail. I start to appreciate the bees buzzing around my head and the trees creaking in the wind. These moments are wonderful spirit lifters. Though it may seem like we have all the time in the world, we are still working hard. There are many times that it's hard to stop and smell the flowers and see the views. We have to hike a certain amount of miles each day based on how much food we have on our back. Some days are long and hard, and when we make it to camp, it's all we can do just to set up our tent, eat, and go to sleep. Timing has been a big struggle for us. Many days, we are the last out of camp in the morning and the last into camp at night. It's disheartening when we compare our camping and hiking styles to others, so we try not to do it. Instead, we make small goals. Leave camp by 8 a.m., hike half our miles by noon, and get to camp by 6 p.m. If we can meet one or two of these goals in one day, it's a good day. If we can meet all three goals, it's a great day. One thing about being out here is learning to appreciate the little things. Yesterday, I was dragging, so I sprawled out on the grass and took a 15-minute nap in the warm sun. Now, I'm not a napper, but that nap in the sun could easily convert me. I'm thinking back to that warm sun now as I'm shivering in my sleeping bag in the famous Overmountain shelter, only mildly protected from the 50-mile-per-hour winds blowing up the mountain outside. I can't believe how volatile the weather is in the mountains. One day, sweat is pouring down my temples, and the next day, my arms are covered in goosebumps under my rain jacket. It's hard to make long-term plans out here. Little elements of each day are constantly changing, from the weather to the terrain to my own energy levels. One day we can hike 15 miles without blinking an eye, and the next day we might struggle to make it 10 miles. Hiking the Appalachian Trail has been a lesson in both patience and flexibility. I'm learning to accept the things that don't go as planned and to adjust my mindset as things happen. Although it's a challenge to make it to every single campsite we stop at, I welcome each challenge with open arms. These are the experiences that I hope will build me up and make me stronger. Pushing through the hard stuff makes the beautiful moments so much sweeter. And there are many, many beautiful moments to be thankful for. Well, we're 400 miles down, and I'm looking forward to the next 400 miles and beyond.
Contributor Lauren Groh is joining us from time to time as she thru-hikes the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine this year. You can hear her past dispatches and follow her journey from links at WUWM.com.
From through hiking to Paul Theroux, one more break, and then a tour of another exotic locale, the fictional place called Motherland, the setting for Paul Theroux's novel of the same name. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Paul Theroux is widely regarded as one of the finest living American writers. But really, he's a writer of the world. His 50-year career encompasses travelogues such as The Old Patagonian Express and Deep South, and novels ranging from Mosquito Coast to Hotel Honolulu.
His latest novel, at times, reads like a travel memoir through an exotic and often unpleasant place called Motherland. That's the title of the novel, in fact, an epic-length depiction of a large family with a tyrannical mother at its center, a virtual dictator in a closed-off society. It's narrated by one of the family's sons, a writer named Jay, who does bear a few similarities to Theroux himself. We reach Paul Theroux at his home in Hawaii. It is a pleasure to speak with you.
Mitch, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
I want to start in maybe a strange place here. There is a scene in this book where Jay, our narrator, who is a writer himself, finds out that his sister has resold a book that he has signed to her. And I wonder, as a writer, when you encounter something like that, one of your books that's resold, that's been inscribed to someone, does it cut you to the core? Is it an awful thing to do?
Yeah, it does. It does happen, though. It does happen. And if I may say so, it's happened to me. Many books that I've inscribed to people have ended up on abooks.com or biblio.com. Memorably, I inscribed some books to V.S. Naipaul, my mentor.
Sure.
And I was shocked when I saw them. And I even said, what's that all about? And it was really to do with house cleaning by his second wife. That triggered a discussion. And then the end of a friendship, which I wrote about in Servidia's Shadow. And then subsequently, we became friends again. So we're the best of friends at the moment. So the fact that someone sells your books doesn't necessarily mean that's the end of the line. But it does happen. It does happen.
Well, and speaking as someone who has more or less accidentally purchased a book that has been inscribed to someone else, I have to say, as a reader and the owner of this book, it's a strange feeling to have this book in your collection that was inscribed and ostensibly with some thought given to the inscription to someone else.
Yes, it is, because it's a very personal thing of either dedicating a book to someone, which is the ultimate, or then inscribing it in a tender, meaningful way, and then, and then they say that it gives it added value.
I feel like we should talk a little more about Mother. Mother is the supreme leader in the middle of this family that you write about, and Jay, our narrator, describes it as like Albania at its most Maoist.
Yeah.
Do you think is there something in the dynamic of large families, even the ones without this particular kind of mother figure in them? Are they like closed-off countries?
Yes, they are. A big family is a nation. It has its own language. They have their own customs. They have their own little rituals of, you know, what do they do on a Saturday night, or what they do every Thanksgiving, or little sayings. Mother always says this. Dad always says this. You drop something. I remember if I dropped something, my father used to say, lazy man's load. Lazy man's load was taking, you know, carrying more than you should, so you drop something. So a lazy man's load. I've never heard anyone else say that. That was a saying in the family. And so a family is a nation. A nation is a group of like-minded people with their own customs, their own cruelties, their own enemies. And they behave differently when they're on their own in the house than they are outside. Outside, there's smiles and everything's fine. It's usually regarded as a big, happy family. But as Tolstoy said, happy families are all alike. The unhappy families, the dysfunctional families, they're different, always in very interesting ways. So, yes, it kind of replicates Albania, Cambodia under Pol Pot, or, you know, what have you. And the mother figure in this book has characteristics of the tyrant. She's not a reader in political philosophy, but she has the characteristic of a despot. She's kind of come up with her own version of brother number one, you know, Pol Pot or Chairman Mao. That was the book's value to me. You write often to understand a situation. I mean, in my case, if I'm writing a novel, I'm trying to figure something out. Who is this person? Where have they been? Where are they going? Where are they at the moment? What is this family? Often, a writer's first subject is his family, because, or her family, because there's nothing else to write about it. A person's 21 or 22 years old. They've lived in a family. They go out, then they go to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and the person says, write something. And so they write a novel. Well, what? It's usually about the family. I didn't do that. I joined the Peace Corps and went to Africa and wrote novels and short stories and travel about Africa and then Southeast Asia, where I went subsequently. I didn't really start thinking about my family till my father died, actually, and as happens in the book. And my mother took on a new persona, as often happens when a spouse dies. The surviving spouse becomes slightly different, needs loyalty from the people. And they're mourning the dead spouse, but also they're in sole control of the family. So I was trying to figure that out.
Well, and the point gets made pretty late in the book, and by a pretty minor character, that we are all still children while our parents are still alive, which maybe seems like the key to understanding the whole book.
Yes, it is. It's interesting that you should say that, because I often pictured the characters of this book as big children, middle-aged, graying, balding, overweight children, big people in shorts. Sometimes you see people at the beach, and you think, that's so weird. They're dressed like children, but they're big, fat people. Or they're big, you know, tall, skinny people, whatever they are.
Right.
They're old, but they're dressed like little kids. And I often depicted it that way. When a parent is still living, you're still a son or a daughter. You're still a child. And And often, if you're near the mother, you behave like children. I mean, spitefully, revengefully, or kindly, as the case may be. But you're still children. It's only when your parents have passed away that you assume full measure of adulthood, I think.
Well, and in that way, I wanted to ask, and I don't think this is a spoiler, following mother's death at 102 at the end of this book, the book ends with the narrator signing off with the date and place the way a preface would. Should we be looking at the first 70 or so years of Jay's life as something of a preface?
I suppose so. I mean, it is kind of a preface. I will say the last fourth of the book, a quarter of the book, is a love story. And things have changed, as they do. It's not just about the mother as an old tyrant all the time. When she gets older, she becomes a kind of sacred figure. She becomes like a little yellow goddess sitting in the corner of a room emitting an aura. And Jay notices how he's now more forgiving. And then he falls in love. The mother has a caregiver. And it's not a spoiler to say that the caregiver has the same name as a child that had died at birth and the mother venerated. So it's, I guess it's all prologue in a way, that the author, Jay, is not me. He's a version of me, I suppose, but it's not me. He's a fellow kind of down on his luck, living 10 minutes from mother, as one of the chapter headings. If you're living 10 minutes from your mother, really, you haven't gone very far in the world. You're still kind of looking after her. And he's living in a rented house. I'm speaking to you from Hawaii in a very salubrious place, so obviously I'm not him. But I think you assume at the end of the book that he's moving on to bigger and better things.
Right. I mean, I think if we think of childhood as kind of a preface to the rest of our life, you know, he's had a very long preface at this point.
Yeah, that's true. But as long as your parents are alive, you're still children. And in a way, there's still hope because your parents haven't passed away. So this, you don't even think about death. You think, I'm still a boy. I'm responding to my mother. I'm being treated like a child, like, as, you know, mothers or fathers often think of their children. I think of my children who are, you know, in their 40s. I think of them as boys, as kids. But they're men. And the conceit in the book is that these are all very badly behaved children in a family who are being manipulated by the mother. But the sign of their childishness is that they allow themselves to be manipulated.
And it doesn't, again, come until sort of fairly late in the book that Jay really starts to question what it was that made his mother the person that she was, certainly at the end of her life.
Yes, it's very hard to know why people are the way they are, particularly, you know, when I was growing up, I had really no sense of how my parents were raised. They were very secretive about it, very close-mouthed. They didn't discuss it much, not because there was anything to be ashamed of, but they didn't feel as if I was at an age to understand. I mean, there was a big gap between my parents and me in terms of familiarity. I had to call my father sir and father, and I had to be very respectful. Nowadays, people call, they don't say, they even say my mom. They say, you know, Betty doesn't want me to smoke weed. I don't know what Betty's problem is. You say, who's Betty? Well, Betty's my mom. And you think, I don't know, it's weird. But so I wasn't familiar with my parents' background. I heard a lot of stories. I mean, for example, that my grandmother was a Native American, a Menominee from Wisconsin, actually. That was cause of consternation. My father didn't know quite how to deal with it because my father was French-Canadian ethnicity. And he thought, well, he was very pro-French, but he didn't know quite how to think about, you know, Aboriginal people. So that was a big issue. My mother, I never really understood my mother. So in the book, you just assume they grew up before the First World War. They went through the Depression, you know, in their 20s, and then the Second World War. And then the further thing, the 50s, which were very repressive, and then the Vietnam War, and then the Civil Rights Movement. There were a lot of pressures and not much money. So basically, they were trying to raise a family, and the past didn't really figure, except in those kind of anecdotal stories that really don't tell you very much. So Jay, the character, doesn't know much about his mother, but he sees little glimpses of how she might have been raised in a narrow, difficult way.
Well, and he is really the only person that we see demonstrating any introspection, you know, sort of familial introspection at all, although I guess it's possible that any of the other characters could have been the narrator, but it's hard as we see them to imagine them giving much thought to, you know, why Mother was the person that she was at all.
Yes, that's true, and it's largely true because each person in a family has a different parent. Depending on your birth order, the circumstances of your birth and the condition of the family when you were born determines a lot of the attention that you got. So the eldest is usually a very responsible person. The eldest is an only child. The youngest, in a way, is an only child, too. But all the way through, any member of the family would have a different take on what the parents. And I should say also that this is a novel. This isn't really a book about my family. It's a book that was motivated by being in a big family, but I sourced a lot of it. A lot of the more preposterous episodes in it actually happened. And then other parts, I mean, the other 40% is pure invention.
I couldn't shake, it took me maybe 100, maybe 150 pages before I started thinking of Motherland in terms of the current political climate. You know, Mother has obviously classic narcissistic traits. We have a president today who many describe in similar terms. Do you see the country going through a period like the Justice family of Motherland, you know, warring factions and people competing for love and affection and money?
I absolutely do. And you notice that the president is obsessed with his family, and he's a classic narcissist, a bully, very thin-skinned, difficult man, obviously with someone who resonates with many people, with me. I mean, my last book was about traveling through the South, the Deep South, and I went through lots of places that had been devastated by economic ruin of factories moving to Mexico or China. And when Trump mentioned that and Hillary didn't, I thought, this message is one that I understand. So it's two ways of looking at the South. As a patriarch, though, he has that. He's mercurial. He's difficult. People they want to please him, just the way you want to please your parent. How are we going to deal with Mom or Dad and not make him mad? Is this going to make him mad? And often a parent will say, you know, I'm going to tell your father, or I'm going to tell your mother, whatever it is. So the narcissism, thin-skinned, patriarchal, obsessed with children, seeing the country as a family, I mean, that's rather a touching thing. See, we're a nation, we're all one, and the rest of the world doesn't matter. That was another message that he had. So my novel, Motherland, kind of replicates this condition of a dominant single parent, because you think of Trump not as a married man, but as a patriarch who has this kind of harem. You don't think of them too much. You just think about him. And my impulse to write the book was to write about a dominant mother figure and how you respond to it. My mother made me a writer, not because she read to me and encouraged me. My mother didn't like my writing. She didn't read my books. But as an act of rebellion, I wrote books. You notice now that people are much more creative. They're much more satirical. They're funnier. They're more responsive. They're more engaged because Trump is president. Trump has created this resistance. And he's also made a lot of people think hard about who they are, where they are, and what they want. Hillary wouldn't have done that. So, I mean, I'm not a big Trump supporter, but you can see that how a negative reaction or a negative figure can create a backlash, but that is innovative, creative, satirical, wonderful. And I think that that's what a writer is. A writer has to have a disturbing vision. They can't get medals at the White House. I'm totally against that. I think whenever a writer gets a medal at the White House, I think, you know, you're a lost cause.
Motherland is not actually a geographic place, but if there were a geographic place that Mother's sphere of influence includes, it would be Cape Cod, which is, I know, where you spend part of your years. We're talking to you in Hawaii, and I wonder if there's something inherent about Cape Cod in this book, or could it actually take place in Hawaii?
Cape Cod lends itself to the story as a place that I know well. I was partly raised there. A lot of the story is determined by the weather. The first paragraph of the book begins, weather is memory, even the wind matters. And there's something about weather that a certain season of the year, a certain month, a certain temperature often brings memories back. And it does that profoundly I would imagine in Wisconsin, I think certainly in New England, not so much in Hawaii. In Hawaii, we have balmy weather all the year, and it's not weather isn't memory here. But big families are a feature of Hawaiian life, and in some cases, very, very big families. So it could play out here. Such a book could be written here about a matriarch, but it would be a different book. It wouldn't be the grind. You know, something about the winter on the Cape, which is very hard, it's raw, it's not particularly cold, but it's very bitter. It's a damp wind.
Right. Bleak, the word bleak comes to mind.
Bleak, yeah, very, very bleak. And also the leaves are off the trees, so you see it differently. You see it, it's somehow naked. That's a feature of the book, too, because that's part of the mood of it. But I was very happy with the book. You know, I'm toward the end of my writing life. I published my first novel 50 years ago, 1967. It was called Waldo. So this is, you know, 50 years later, here's my novel. And that's actually about a family and about growing up in a family, and is, instead of an autobiography, in the same spirit that I think Dickens was going to write an autobiography, but he wrote David Copperfield instead. David Copperfield isn't his life, but it's a great novel. And I think I wanted to write a great novel rather than a mildly interesting autobiography.
Well, I think you have succeeded. Paul Theroux, it has been a true pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we'll see you in Milwaukee one of these days.
You definitely will. Thanks, Mitch. I look forward to it.
Paul Theroux is the author of more than 40 books, including novels, short stories, and travelogues. His latest is the novel Motherland. One part of Theroux's lineage led directly from Wisconsin, and we reached him at his home in Hawaii. That's the Monday edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You can find us here every weekday morning at 10, and we're glad you were with us today. For Lake Effect, from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is just ahead.